From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Welcome to this Tuesday morning edition of the Oxford Exxon Podcast. Actually going up around lunch today, however, visiting with Michael Thompson of Ole Miss Athletics. Join him in a second. First, I'll tell you the podcast brought to you every single day by the Oxford Exxon, Highway 6 West in Oxford. Lunch specials, $4.99, two sides bread, 32-ounce drink. And as you see at the pavilion every game day, they have the bottomless refills at all Blue Sky locations throughout Mississippi. So check them out for that. Let them help you out for food or refreshment needs up and down I-55 and elsewhere with Blue Sky. Also, most days we're coming to you from the Clark Ford Studio, Clark Ford in Amory, Mississippi, 662-257-1900, Highway 25 South there in Amory. Remember, when you mentioned the podcast, $500 off a new car from Clark Ford just for listening to us and telling Corey about it. Also, you can reach him anytime that is in business hours and get a quote in as little as 15 minutes. So check them out online and in person in Amory, Clark Ford. Michael, good, I think it's a good morning, but it's around 10:30 as we are getting taped here today. This all started with a message board thread. We've turned it into a podcast, and now here we are.
Yep, I appreciate you being here. I tried to bring some fans to the office and even have a conference dial in, but it didn't work out. This is what people wanted, so that's even better.
Yeah, were you going to have like refreshments? I mean, we're going to be pretzels.
I had planned on it.
Aramark could come over, or Center Plate, or
Center Plate. I was going to give Darren a quick call at Center Plate and see if he'd kind of put together a little spread, and we'd go in the conference room and have a good talk.
I'm going to get to a good bit. We took questions from subscribers, letting most of you guys hash it out. I kind of put some things in priority. I mixed some questions, but I'll try to get to as much as I can. But I'll start with this before we get into that. You took this job, and almost immediately all this stuff started. I mean, I get the appeal and different things are going on, but is there some sense of normalcy even in your position finally starting to where, you know, you take this and it's, hey, let's brand the university and let's do this and let's do fan engagement. And Bessalade plans, that went on back burner pretty quickly, it seems, considering everything that's happened.
Yeah, well... That's an interesting way of putting it. I started here in 2010, and so if you remember, that was coming off of two consecutive Cotton Bowls, and I was hired in August of that year, started in August of 2010, you know, with a what we thought was a great roster and with a lot of promise and a lot of expectations for that year. And
again, Jeremiah Masoli.
I mean, that was one of the first things I worked on. I got thrown into that a little bit to work on that waiver. And then Jacksonville State is the first game, my first game. I mean, it was like the second or third week on the job. Mm-hmm. It was very, very quickly realized that, okay, we're going to learn how to build this brand. Win or lose, rain or shine, we're going to have to create a really, really strong emotional connection with our fans to do this, because you can't count on winning. This conference is too good. I mean, look at last night. I mean, this conference is the best in so many sports. And so you literally cannot bank on going undefeated every year. And so you've got to be intentional and you've got to be strategic about how you market the program, how you build this brand, how you continue to get fans to come back game in, game out, rain or shine, cold or hot, and not just to football. I mean, we have so many sports and we have so many student athletes that need our fan support. So that was a big wake up call of okay, we're gonna get and roll up our sleeves and start to really learn. That's where the survey was born. That season, because there was fans would come into my office, you know, every day, and I'd meet with fans and they'd talk about what things should happen in the stadium. And that's when we put the research tool together to, all right, let's quantify this. Let's figure out how we can improve the game day experience so that we can be the best.
We had some different stuff, and I'm going to start out with some lesser ask about things, basically so we don't forget them, because if I get caught up in minutia later with some different topics, then that's that. One of the big things from the past fall was the mascot. Switching to the land shark from the bear. You were kind of right there with the implementation of the bear back in the day and all that stuff. I remember it sitting in either your office or somebody else's office right before it got going. I think this is fair, and I think you'd agree. There wasn't a huge push to monetize the bear. I think in some ways, at least in my opinion, it felt that there was so much, I'll call it weird backlash in a lot of ways, that it was kind of always called on a seesaw of up and down and what exactly to do with it. I guess, would you agree with that? And then are there plans to monetize, to push? What's kind of the different marketing element for the new one as that comes along?
Yeah, so that was day, I think, 10 on the job is when the final vote from the Ole Miss community was done for the bear, and it was kind of like, okay, here it is, you guys launch it. And again, day 10, and then Jacksonville State was maybe day like 20. I mean, that was an interesting first month. But that is probably one of the trickiest, most challenging things that I've worked on, only because it was explosive. I mean, when I say explosive, it was unbelievable, the reaction from some fans, not everybody, but it was probably the most polarizing thing, that you're sitting here holding on to this object, this mascot, this program, and you just know through, I mean, it's a fact that it's so polarizing, and so you're in a weird spot, and so you got to give it a chance, but you can't go full bore with it, because then you're quote unquote shoving it down people's throats. I mean, then it's just you become out of touch with fans. So it was a very delicate thing. I mean, if you remember, we launched, we unveiled the mascot at Batson Children's Hospital later that summer, and so it was. I mean, that was intentional. I mean, we had to find a place that it was going to be safe for him. I mean, that whole mascot program was something that from the get-go, it just did not have a chance. It did not have a chance to really thrive the way that a real mascot program should. For example, we were extremely limiting on you know, video board shots. Rebel was not in the Grove. I mean, and this was not because we didn't want him to be, you know, endeared or accepted or anything like that. It was for safety. And so we had
to. You really think there would have been potential harm?
Oh, no question. I mean, he had the amount of drinks that he had spilled on him, or poured on him, not spilled. It was very intentional. And the things that people would say, it would make your skin crawl a little bit. I mean,
his most endearing moment to lots of the fan base was the box on his head against Louisiana Tech.
I'll never forget that night. But and when that happened,
yeah, what goes through your head?
Did you
fire the kid the next morning?
I can't remember exactly what discipline had happened, but I mean, that was a low, low moment. But it was funny. It was a low, low moment, but people. It was endearing to some people, because I think he did what a lot of fans in that moment.
Came at a time when everything was such duress.
He was off the reservation script, but and we had to discipline him as such. But it was still something that he endeared himself. That may have been his one shining moment,
so
which is kind of sad.
Had you really pushed it hard, that more kids would at least had a chance to see that there would have been a more acceptance if he said, "Hey, we're going to do this. We're going to put merchandise here into this. We're going to go full blast." What would have happened?
Well, we strategically made the decision to go slow.
Okay.
And because of the polarizing effect that he had, and who knows? I mean, maybe if we had gone full bore and that it would have worked, you know, we will never know. I don't think it would have. I think it probably would have made things worse. We were hyper targeting children, and I mean, our Rebel Kids Club had 850 members. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, that was big. I mean, that was the club before that was maxed at like 200, I think.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a great kids club because we were super intentional about pushing it and marketing it to children. I mean, that's we had kind of a document about, look, Rebel will appear at just about any event as long as children are the focus. And that's what we did. In the meantime, for those fans who don't have children, I mean, it looked like we weren't doing anything with them at all. But in reality, we were doing stuff with them. But it was hyper targeted to the one audience that we knew that we wanted to get acceptance with, and get acceptance with fast, and the one audience that loved him. I mean, just absolutely loved him. So that's now fast forward. We're looking at a totally different deal now.
Okay.
I mean, when after the Landshark, well, you don't even have to say after Landshark. Even while Rebel Bear was our mascot, I mean, think about how much stuff we did in stadium, in arena, across our sports with Landshark, Mystique, and Fins Up. I mean, it was way more part of the experience than any kind of bear stuff. I mean, you think about a video board feature with any kind of bear thing, it was non-existent. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it would have been just booed. Meanwhile, though, Landshark had such an awesome organic following and organic interest and passion that it made sense. And I've told people before, it's like if those students, whenever that was in 2008 or 2009, whenever they started the petition to have an on-field mascot, mm-hmm. if that had happened maybe 2 years later or 3 years later, I don't think it wouldn't even been a question. It would have been Landshark all the way, because Landshark grew so fast organically and may have actually grown because it was not. So a lot of different things that can happen in that psychologically. But when the Landshark announcement was made, I mean, it was almost immediate. I mean, people were already wearing shark stuff. People were already wearing shark hats, shark costumes. You know, there were already some marks that had been created from other other licensees that you know, people were buying. It's something that there was already this natural foundation of buy-in for. And so when we launched the Landshark, it's gonna be totally different. I mean, we're going full bore.
Okay.
Because it's not polarizing. There are people that, I don't know if anyone, I'm not sure I've had anyone come to me and say, I hate Landshark. Now,
there were criticisms about timing, about those type of things, but not about the actual entity that I'm aware of.
That's what I'm aware of, too. I mean, it just seems like a natural thing. Now, it wasn't our call to do it. I mean, it was the students brought it to the table and really wanted to do it. I mean,
was there a worry not enough people were polled? Because, I mean, you know, you have talk quotes about family, you know, the Ole Miss family, yeah, and things, but it was still a relatively very small segment that kind of factored
students
into it.
Yeah, undergraduate students. But, you know, the way that we went about bringing in other constituent groups, Faculty Senate, the Alumni Association, okay. The different external groups, the UM Foundation Board, there are other groups that had heard from their membership and from their constituents, and they wholeheartedly endorsed this. And so what timing, I mean, again, that's something that's really not part of our control. And that's something that when it's time to go, it's time to go, and we go. And we're going to take it and run with it. And we're going full bore on this one. There's no question about it, because we can. And it'll be fun that way. And the people that worked on the mascot program, this was so exciting for them, because they finally get to do what they do best. And that's, you know, having normal mascot program where we can send a mascot into the Grove. We can do different things. We can put the mascot on the video board without any kind of fear of something happening. So hopefully there won't be a lot of drinks spilled on this one.
Got to focus on fan experience a little bit, tickets, different things. Is there a concern with the lack of donations being tax deductible and things now? I mean, how does a university kind of prepare or handle that new legislation?
It's tricky. And no one, no school, I guess all of us are in the same boat, trying to kind of figure out how is this going to affect the overall season ticket base. How is it going to affect priority seating? And, you know, no one knows. Literally, no one knows. And if somebody tells you how, then they're not telling you the truth. They're speculating. So we don't know either. We're doing some research now. We'll have our annual fund membership survey will go out in about 10 days, about 12 days. So we've got a couple of questions on that survey about that, trying to understand people's awareness of the new laws, as well as how they think it will affect them. But I mean, we still have the same number of seats in the stadium, and we'll still have season tickets and things like that. I think it's going to be up to each individual, each family, to kind of figure out how all of that works, because you're getting breaks, you're getting other deductions, and so it's probably going to be a wash. It's just going to be from different buckets.
I mean, it's up to the schools almost from a PR standpoint to point out, yeah, to really specify and point out how things are.
That's right.
Are going. I mean, obviously you guys too. I mean, you've been caught up in this every single day, but the fan base that's been really beaten down by all the NCAA stuff since 2013. How do you balance revenue necessities, prices, ticket plans on kind of understanding maybe where your fan base is right now, but then also just having to kind of fit in what everybody else is doing and stay with your current spot, obviously.
You do it very carefully, and you do it strategically, and you do it with a lot of thought and a lot of research. And you're right. I mean, this is our fans. Look, I'm one of them. I mean, I'm an alum. Our fans have been through a tremendous amount. And there's incredible opportunity ahead of us, like incredible opportunity. I think we're about to see a shift in momentum that's going to be where you're almost going to feel it. And that's something that I'm looking forward to. The fans are, there's no question about this in my mind. And we've talked about this since I got here, since Ross got here. I mean, we've got to have a fans first mentality. We just do. The fans are our customers. And you know, on the agency side where I come from, I mean, that's all you talk about. It's customers, 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 customers. They are the lifeblood of who you are. And this year, and we kind of soft launched this on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, but there'll be a press kit and a press release coming out later today about the Year of the Fan. And this is something that 2018 we have kind of dubbed the Year of the Fan. To our knowledge, I mean, no one has done what we're about to do, or at least on the scale that we're about to do it.
We've teased it on the show.
Yeah, it is. This is going to be a really special year for our fans. The things that they'll get to do in our facilities, things they're going to get to do with our coaches and at games, throughout social media and all of our digital platforms, it is going to be awesome. I mean, it's going to be really, really cool. I mean, we'll have a fan pro day. You think of kind of like the NFL combine, but okay. But for fans, where you can come in as a fan and run the 40-yard dash, see how you compare to, Carlos Davis or Mike Wallace some of our other current players, or see how you compare to your friends. We'll have, the vertical jump. We'll be able to catch punts, be able to, do all kinds of fun stuff like that. We're still working out, location and a rain plan, and that happens in dates, but it'll be sometime in April, we think. And but there'll be fun stuff too, like a hot dog eating contest. I mean, how fast can you eat two hot dogs? I mean, how fast can you set up a Grove tent and eight chairs? And so there'll be some fun, like family stuff that's not all, for the 19-year-old fan who maybe was a former high school football player that wants to see how fast, he is, or how he can throw in a QB, throwing contest, something like that. But so that's just one of this, long, long, long list that will grow throughout the year of things that we want to do to give back to our fans and have our fans really get to experience things that they haven't gotten to experience. I mean, we'll be able to, hit a golf shot from one of the upper levels of upper concourses of Vaught Hemingway down to the 50 for all kinds of prizes one day. We'll have a fantasy radio booth where you'll get to sit in this little interactive booth at a football game or basketball game or baseball game and actually call the game, play by play and color with a buddy of yours or with a family member, and we'll send you with a recording of that when it's over. And so these different, experiences that people can get are important. We'll have a fan of the week every week. We're going to post on social. But the idea is we also want to learn more about our fans. We want to hear more of our fan stories. And so a big part of the Year of the Fan is fans submitting their stories. And it could be their favorite Ole Miss memory. It could be their first Ole Miss memory. It could be a family member or relative that has a consecutive game streak. It could be a story about the grandfather of his first game. It could be it could be anything. And so we're really going to be encouraging fans to share their story. And once they do, they're going to have a chance to, you know, lock the vault with the team. They'll have a chance to lead the team down the walk of champions, fire the cannon after a score. That's just a football. We'll have all kinds of different first pitch baseball. It's going to be extensive and something that grows, and it is something that we're going to just be adding to throughout the year. So that's going to be, you know, omyearofthefan.com. That's up right now.
We take a break to tell you that the podcast is also brought to you by Oxford University Bank. OUB is locally owned and operated right here in Oxford. When you deposit money at OUB, that money and the vast majority of the bank's profits go right back into the Oxford community. Oxford University Bank gives you the comfort of home, all the benefits the big mega banks provide, all the technology and products you want, all with the personal touch. When you call OUB, you speak directly with the live person, all without having to press 10 buttons, without a 5-minute wait. OUB is offering 1-year CDs at 1.75% annual percentage yield and 3-year triple option CDs paying 2.01% APY. With the 3-year term, customers can deposit once during the term, withdraw once during the term, and or bump the rate if OUB's 3-year rate rises. To learn more about OUB, check out liveoxfordbankoxford.com or call 662-234-6668. OUB is FDIC insured. Rebel Nation, 2018 is the year of the fan. Ole Miss Athletics wants to showcase your stories and recognize you, the Ole Miss fan base. Exciting prizes and experiences throughout the year will be featured on omyearofthefan.com and updated often. Be sure to visit omyearofthefan.com. Ole Miss entertains Florida on Saturday at noon at the Pavilion at Ole Miss. Tickets available, olemisstix.com. That's olemisstix.com. The podcast also brought to you by Harry Alexander. Harry is an Oxford-based RE/MAX Legacy Realty agent. Harry's been in Oxford more than 4 decades, and no one knows the residential and condo market in Oxford better than Harry. Go to his site. He'll prove it to you. It's harryalexander.com. Click on the Properties and Neighborhoods tab at the top left. Filter through by what you're looking for, then send him an email. It's ha@harryalexander.com. And the podcast is brought to you by Grenada Nissan. If you're in the market for a Nissan vehicle, look no further than Grenada Nissan. All the new 2018s are in stock, as are previously owned Nissans. As we always tell you, great lease deals. If you are driving 12 to 15,000 miles a year, you want a new vehicle at a 1990s price, Grenada Nissan has it. It's GrenadaNissanUSA.com. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
It's cool. I like all that. From, I guess, thinking about when I was taking these questions in last night, in my head, there's not a lot of flexibility. From a monetary standpoint, where is there flexibility to give fans a break? I mean, whether it be, you know, the Falcons had really cheap concession prices or tickets. I mean, do you do packages? What do you do to try to alleviate some of those things for the, you know, the family of four that's driving from Biloxi and spending their Saturday and the next Sunday morning to give just that little bit of incentive to not sit at home on the TV? Because I think that's got to be an atmosphere thing. That's got to be a monetary thing. That's got to be so many different levels at a time when everybody's got to be worried about it, but it doesn't seem like the SEC has fallen off as much as a lot of the rest of the country in that regard.
Yeah, and it's, again, it goes back to what you were talking about too, is balancing the need that we need to grow, obviously. But we've got to be mindful of where our fans are. I mean, and where they are financially, and you know, I believe everybody else is raising season ticket prices pretty much as an annual thing. We're not; they'll stay the same. And then if you renew by a certain date, we really want to reward you. And so if you renew your football season tickets before January 31st, you're getting one brick per ticket. So if you have a ticket, if you have a family of four, you get four season tickets, you're getting four bricks. You can put whatever you want on those bricks. They're going to go, you know, in the letter winner's walk or in the pavilion plaza. I mean, something that's forever. And in addition, you're getting 20 bucks in concessions vouchers per ticket. So that's 80 bucks if you had family of four. I mean, that's there's some free concessions right there. Mm-hmm. And you're getting all kinds of other, you know, 40% off at rebelwallart.com and at the Rebel Shop, you're getting 20% off. And so we've got kind of this tiered, you know, really trying to reward those fans that renew earlier And purchase earlier. And then you also have your enter to win, you know, a chance to have lunch with Coach Luke or travel with the team to an away game, things like that. So we're really trying to make the trying to bonus those fans and give those fans things that they may not otherwise get through this year's renewals, and it's something that we're excited about. And especially the bricks. I mean, the bricks thing is one of those things where, you know, I think it's $100-something to get a brick normally. I mean, you're getting it free with your ticket if you renew by the 31st. And that's something that's forever. I mean, those bricks are forever. It's something you can show your kids, your grandkids. You can come down and see it every game when you walk to the stadium. So those are the things that we're trying to add in that make that purchase even more valuable.
Do you expect any movement, or has there been any talk about Grove monetization moving forward?
You know, that's something that somebody people ask all the time. And it's one of those things that at very first glance or very first discussion seems like, oh, I mean, that makes sense. The more you think about it, though, it's extremely complicated, like extremely complicated. And one of the first ways that gets complicated is that it's not a square. The Grove is not a square, and it's not gridded. If you think about the number of tree roots in there, not every spot is at a 90-degree angle. Now it just doesn't fit.
You would almost
grid.
Need an aerial of the entire thing and go, okay, ten. Like it would be a complex engineer thing.
It would be an extremely complicated thing. And then when you do that, all right, well, what happens, you know, for massive games, you know, big SEC games, you know, afternoon games, night games versus another game. So now you have this weird kind of uneven sparseness of what's happening, because you've got these spots on the Walk of Champions that somebody has bought, you know, or leased,
be reserved,
or whatever,
just for the Alabama and the LSU and the Georgia games.
Right, and so for the other games, they're just sitting there, and it's wide open. And that's just, it's just a weird – the way that the mystique of the Grove and the history of the Grove is so unique. It is so awesome. And look, it has plenty of challenges with it being first come, first served. Plenty of challenges. It's a Friday night that's hard on my staff. I mean, because we're out there, and there are people from all across the university that have a role in that too. But I mean, it would be, put it this way, it would be much easier to do that, but it wouldn't necessarily. Easier logistically, but it wouldn't necessarily be the right thing to do. And at the end of the day, it may not accomplish what we want to accomplish. And we want to have the best game day experience ever. And that starts in the Grove and Circle or wherever, but it culminates in the stadium. And so it's all part of this one day that you're coming up here. And that's something that we've got to continue just to build and foster and protect. And it just doesn't seem like the thing to do to really have that awesome game day experience. It just doesn't fit.
Something that I say struggle, not really in the standpoint of fail, more of in something you've talked about with me since you took this job. Has there been any more thought on different things to do from getting the Grove to the stadium and the pregame and just kind of the overall? I think so much of this, in my opinion, is about consistent winning, and it just, you know, Florida does the two bits thing, which I find incredibly stupid, but they win and people seem to do it, and it sort of is what it is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But cheers, what's on the board? Are there things that you see that fall flat? Do you have to constantly change those things? And how much of that is really not knowing exactly how well it works or doesn't work because of crowd attendance and overall mood and atmosphere of the building?
Yeah, I think I can probably answer a couple of your questions in this one, because your follow-up I think is going to be about the pregame cheer. There was a couple of comments on that, and people have asked me about it. There's one guy, I can't remember his Twitter handle now, but I'm telling you, literally every single game, as soon as that cheer is over, I get tweeted at, and it's like, make it stop. And so, you know, it's, that is such a catch 22 in some ways. Throughout the research that we've done, and we do this for all 14 schools now, the fan experience research, and we do it for five sports. The one of the most consistently ranked elements of the game day experience across the board, across all of our sports, across pretty much the SEC, is organized cheers and crowd participation. Our fans, especially students, but all of our fans, are craving what they call, what we call in the survey, organized cheers and crowd participation. And they also, there's another question that they're that we're measuring in there, which is just like game day stadium traditions, you know, cheers, walks, chants. And both of those always come to the top of the list when it comes to how important they are. And so every year we are constantly, okay, how do we attack this particular part of the survey? How do we improve our satisfaction score here? We know how important it is. The importance level of that, of those two elements, has not changed since we started doing the survey. They're number one, number two, number three, somewhere in this kind of, you know, ping pong around in those areas. And so it's a tricky deal because, for example, Lock the Vault came from that and came from a couple of students who came in and brought in. That's like, okay, this is a great idea. The students came in, and it really does go to the survey score of, you know, stadium traditions. Is something to be cool. It's not necessarily a cheer, but it's a tradition. And that's not that old. Was it 5 years old, six years old? And when we started that, I mean, I'll never forget it. I mean, it was like, oh man, first game was like, oh gosh, this is falling flat. Like, this is falling flat. And you get to do it the next game and the next game and the next game and the next game. And eventually, I mean, that took a whole season for just to get a little bit of buy-in that was like noticeable if you're standing on the field to look around. And, you know, the next year was a little bit more. Now that has really become a really neat tradition that we started 5 or 6 years ago, from the survey and from the students who came and brought it to us. And it's something that, again, right when it first started happening, your knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, that didn't work. It didn't work. You gotta get rid of it. But these things take time. They take time. And so when it comes to adding new cheers, it's something that we're constantly trying to do is again, attack that question on the survey, that the results on the survey of our fans' craving of organized cheers and crowd participation. We're going to try things. We're going to take risks. We're going to try things that hit at that. And so, you know, we have I think we introduced it this year. Maybe it was the year before, but I think it was this year. We have the mic man at the beginning of the game, pregame, doing a cheer for both sides. And it's one of those things where, again, our fans are craving it. We're trying to create it. And then it's I don't like that cheer. And so if people aren't participating in it, it's not going to be fun to do. Yet if everyone did it, it would be pretty awesome. It would be really, really powerful. And so that's kind of this, there's a catch to it because, if everybody can't just kind of buy in to something like that, then it won't make it. People eventually bought into Lock the Vault, but it didn't happen overnight. And it certainly didn't even happen in the whole first season. And so getting people just to kind of say, okay, well, this may not be my favorite cheer, this is about participating with my fellow fans, and it's about making it loud, and it's about having something that's unique. And I'll tell you what, that would work. If we could get everybody to say it, it would be deafening. But that's one of the challenges that, you know, I don't know if it's all fan bases, but there are, I'm trying to think of how to say this delicately, but there are, There are just ways that some fans, I don't know if it's they're embarrassed or something like that to yell, but some of that is going on in the stadium. And I don't know what it is. They feel like it's hokey or dorky or something like that. But at the end of the day, you know what? We are there to make that stadium loud. We are there to have a home field advantage. And we are trying as a department to put things in place that give fans the opportunity to do exactly that. But if fans don't want to participate in that, then it's just making the overall thing not be as loud and not give us as much of an advantage. And we're going to keep trying things. I mean, we're going to keep taking risks. The Tuberville Hotty Toddy thing was a risk. I don't know if you were going to ask about that, so I just walked right into that. But I mean, we've our staff, and we really tell our staff, look, what. We got to take some risks here. This is a big deal, and we got to hit some home runs. We got to hit some grand slams. Sometimes we're going to strike out. Got it. I mean, I admitted that about the Tuberville thing. I wish I just should have told people ahead of time that we were going to do it. And I think it would have worked better. But
a lot of people didn't realize he was in the stadium.
Right. Yeah. It was too complicated of a jab at him. There were too many moving parts in it. In hindsight,
is he also potentially a bad figure for that? Because the way he left obviously has been documented.
Oh yeah.
At the same time, he did a lot of good too. So he's a really strange mix of. You don't have a lot of fives on opinions on Tommy Tuberville. You've
right.
got zeros and tens. So in doing that, making him somewhat of that figure is already kind of half, weirded out, or depending on how the game's going too, because, I think that was A&M, right?
Yeah.
For A&M, the game's kind of squirrely and whatever's going on.
I think we were up.
We were up at halftime?
Yeah, I think we were up at
He was a strange, in my opinion, a strange case for that, given his polarizing nature.
Oh, no question. It was meant as a troll. Meant as a troll. Like it was a pine box, man. And so, it was one of those things. Again, we're going to take some risks, and some of them will strike out. And that one was a strikeout. I think. I mean, a lot of. I got way more comments way after several days later that, like, man, I loved it. I thought it was hilarious. But you don't want to do something like that that even splits your base. That wasn't smart. But again, I think if we had told people ahead of time that we were going to do it, I think it would have gotten more laughs. It was supposed to be more of a boo and a laugh and move on. I mean, it was supposed to be fun.
Has there And I feel like you guys have done this, honestly. It's better than it used to be. Alabama does the neat thing with the former players bringing out balls and different things. I mean, what are some ways to kind of, especially as their NFL presence continue to get former athletes involved in your game day, but just kind of your program in general?
Yeah, that's something that we have been striving to do. Their voice and their amount of influence is so powerful. It's so credible. And it's something that we're proud. I mean, we're proud to have these former players across all of our sports. And when they're back, we want to treat them, like kings, and queens. So they're such an important part of our program. We're working on ways that can be more defined and strategic, especially through the M Club, and which are our letter winners club and former letter winners club, and the letter winners walk, which is right out here, which once the bell tower is done later this year, that whole plaza with the letterers walk is just going to be spectacular. And so that's one of those things, like we'll be having events to bring former players back and bring them back around football games, basketball games, baseball games, and really make sure that they have a first class experience and that they're bought in. But like we had Ross did the town hall meeting with former football players before the coach and I were going to do another one of those later this spring and let Coach Luke do Q&A with them and tour them around and really bring them back and we're going to be very, very intentional about bringing former players back into the mix and really I'd say leverage, because it's not about that, it's about bringing them back because they deserve to be brought back. They deserve to be honored, and they bled and sweat and worked their tails off for this brand and for this program. So we want to honor them.
Yeah, the videos were really neat a couple weeks ago after signing day or whatever day that was. They did the iPhone videos and different things. In the new baseball thing, the former players are going to have their own locker room, a place to dress, and different things. So that's
going to be awesome.
At Swayze as well. It kind of started with baseball. Alabama a few years ago, A&M started selling alcohol and premium seating, doing some different things. How do you kind of balance that discussion moving forward with selling it versus locker systems and different things?
Well, that's a really, really complicated one, especially here in the state and here in Oxford. And so, there's the SEC rule allows you to sell alcohol in premium areas only. All right, so it's not full stadiums. Who knows? That may change. No earthly idea. And then here in Oxford, you've got a state law in Mississippi that says no alcohol sales whatsoever at collegiate sporting events across the board. Doesn't matter what area you're in, whatever. So there is a state law that prohibits it right now. And then within our city and county, You have different laws about beer or wine and liquor. I think I'm being legally accurate here. No, I'm not a lawyer, so don't quote me on this. But I mean, in the Grove,
it's wine and liquor.
Yeah, legal. Like legal, as long as it's not out for serving.
Right.
But beer is illegal.
Except for the right field area at Swayze, right?
Because that's part of the city. So we have some really interesting lines, yeah, and mapping that goes into this. But the state law of that prohibits sales of alcohol in any way at collegiate sporting events
clearly a hindrance.
Right, it is clearly a hindrance. So if it's something that we want to get to, then there's just a lot of different things that need to change, and some of that stuff may be in motion.
Are there more liability concerns when you do that?
You know, I don't think so.
We're not lawyers. We're just talking.
No, but a lot of the research has come out so far from stadiums that do sell is actually less. Okay. Because it's controlled, monitor, and because you can stop sales. Okay. You can. I mean, you're carding people. I mean, you can limit underage drinking heavily, but you can limit, you can get two beers at a time or whatever, two drinks at a time, and then no drinks in the fourth quarter, or no drinks in past the 8 minute mark. And so a lot of the research that I've seen shows that there's a pretty large decrease in criminal activity, whether it's DUIs or assaults and things like that.
Anything
alcohol related. When it's in a controlled atmosphere, it's not necessarily even about the money. To me, it'd be way more about the safety and really about, if someone brings, hypothetically, if someone were to bring alcohol into the game, sometimes, when that alcohol runs out, they want to go back to the Grove. And we talked a lot about the Grove. I mean, the Grove is, it's like a national treasure. But also when it comes to getting people through those gates at the stadium, it becomes somewhat of a barrier because it's so awesome in the Grove. The experience is so incredible and so unique. It's a bucket list experience. So we don't really have problems at all getting people to campus on a game day. I mean, the Grove is normally going to have more people than the stadium can hold. In fact, I can't think of a single game where the Grove had less people than what the stadium would hold. Yeah. So we have this amazing thing that brings people to campus where a lot of schools are struggling to just get people to campus, not let alone get them into the stadium and get them to campus. We've got them to campus. Now we've got to convert them or at least encourage them and deliver an experience inside of our stadium that it can't be the same as the Grove because it just can't. It's different, but it's got to be as unique and as it's got to be as awesome just in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand.
We take a break from the interview to tell you that the Oxford Exxon podcast is also brought to you by Journey Business Solutions. If you are a business with a high-ticket product or service, HVAC, dentist, surgeon, flooring, furniture, etc., Ben Brown and his team has the best financing solution for your customers. Their program accesses 14 national lenders with one very easy online application. With rates as low as 4.9%, terms that extend to 7 years, loan amounts up to $100,000, and credit scores down to 580, they will get more of your customers the money they need so you don't lose a sale. To hear more about this, call Ben Brown, 443-935-5013. Ben is waiving the setup fee for Oxford Exxon podcast listeners. That's a $500 savings, so call him today. Everybody knows State Farm for being the number one insurer in auto, home, and life insurance. But did you know State Farm has a bank which allows them to do auto financing? Recently, State Farm has had a rate reduction in their commercial insurance rates. Give Romero Miller State Farm a chance to compare your business insurance policies. If you own a rental property, Romero challenges you to give him a shot at that property. You won't be sorry. If you need another reason to give Romero a call, go to Google. Enter Romero Miller State Farm in the search engine and then read the reviews. And if you have insurance needs in Tennessee or Mississippi, you will want to give Romero Miller State Farm a call. 662-893-1212. The podcast is also brought to you by Gambrell & Associates. Gambrell & Associates have three attorneys with more than 60 years of combined experience and more than 45 years handling only bankruptcy and Social Security disability claims. Check out their website at msbnkr.com or by searching for Robert Gambrell on superlawyers.com or avvo.com. Gambrell & Associates handle Social Security disability claims statewide and in Memphis. For more information, call the office in Hernando, 662-342-7700, or in Oxford at 662-281-8800. And finally, the podcast is also brought to you by Comer Heating and Air. Comer Heating and Air has been serving Oxford and the surrounding area for the past 26 years. I've used Comer for AC repair, and you can take my word for it. Their attention to detail, their customer service, and their work is second to none. Comer's an American Standard dealer, but they work on any maker model, residential or commercial. Customers get same-day service, free estimates on new units, and preventative maintenance contracts. Visit their website, ComerHeatingAndAir.com, or check out their Facebook page. Mention you heard about them on the podcast, and you get $20 off. Contact Eric at 662-934-3846 or Shane at 662-832-8749. Now back to the Oxford Exxon podcast.
Question I get a lot, last kind of part of this line of questioning. In the stadium, you and I talked about it off air a second ago. What color to wear what day? And I completely understand. There's a lot of questions about, well, when Auburn comes in, why aren't you wearing blue? When Alabama comes in, why aren't you wearing red? And basically saying that you make the entire stadium look one color. It makes all the sense in the world. It's practical. It's logical. It also is implying that your fans aren't filling up your stadium.
We did talk a little bit of this offline. And I'm smiling right now because it's so tricky. And it's something that we talked about in 2010, 11. In 2011, we remember that year. I mean,
it was ample opportunity for other people in the stadium.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, it almost feels like, and I'm on the fence too. I mean, I'll just be totally honest. I mean, you could go either way. I mean, you really could go either way. There's pros and cons to both sides. There are pros and cons to both sides. You have a really beautiful picture if you do red for Alabama. You got a great aerial shot, right? Really cool picture. But at the same time, if there are a significant amount of Alabama fans there, you give them a little bit of a wait. This may be our stadium kind of feel. Like they're surrounded by friendlies. And that's not what our stadium is about. Our stadium is supposed to be hostile. It's supposed to be a hostile environment for the teams, not the fans. No, there's no fan on fan. I'm not condoning that. But you're supposed to feel like when you go to an opposing stadium, you're supposed to feel like an outsider. That's the whole point of a home field advantage. And so, but again, it works both ways. There's pros and cons of doing it. I think we would get just as much
push back
the other way. And so it's kind of like, look, this is one of those things where we're going to have to agree, disagree, or we're not going to be able to make everyone happy. And so we go to the one that has the least amount of cons, probably the most amount of pros. We have two awesome colors, though. It makes it pretty, and three when you count powder blue. And so it is what it is. But I that's a tough one. That's a really tough one. I don't think we can please everybody.
You've answered this. It's kind of shifted the other part before people want to break my phone and break their phones in half. Probably they're listening.
All right.
You answered a lot of this because there's lots of things. There's the year of the fan. There's ways to enhance things moving forward. I mean, in a lot of ways, you can't, obviously, as much as you love to, erase the NCAA situation. You
right.
can't go back, can't change any of those things. In saying that, and not really a PR standpoint, not because you held a press conference or didn't hold a press conference or said something or didn't say something, just because of maybe the beaten down nature of the fan base of the potentially two years of no bowls, at least one this year because they would have been bowl eligible with the sixth win, all the things they've had to kind of go through. You've got, I'm just using the phrase, you got Joe Fan that's been in Jackson's having to listen to it and deal with it day to day. Is there some element of having to maybe not be more transparent, but give them things and do things to earn back a certain level of, I guess, trust is part of it. And then the other part is just their time and energy that goes into being a fan of a collegiate institution.
There is absolutely no doubt that's what we got to do. I mean, that's what we're going to do. Like, that is what we're going to do. We are going to win back. And, 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 and get the regained the trust and the love of Rebel Nation. I mean, there's no way around that. I mean, and to say that you're not means you have no clue what's happening out there. And so now, how we got there, there's probably plenty of different. We would disagree and agree on several different things of how we got to that place and why it's in that place. But the fact is, it's what we have to do. We've got to win back. We've got to regain the trust of those fans. And so, yes, the answer to that is just unequivocally, yes, we are going to do that.
I've talked to Ross a good bit. I think it was the day of the press conference with he and Vitter discussing sanctions and different things. He said the entire time there was never he had the opinion you didn't fight behind the podium. You fought in the ways that could elicit differences, could elicit change, could go about the process of doing so. Having said that, your job is to market the brand, market different things. What's it been like, and what was the conversation to kind of get to that decision to go that direction? Because of you've got certain journalists that have had certain sources that continue to push things out. You've had narrative issues because of the loudness of certain people and the internet and message boards and different things. So I guess the question is, what were those couple years like, or really serious year where it was really bad, of, I guess, the decision not to try to push back or speak publicly, and then also to bite your tongue and kind of allow all that to happen through that?
Yeah, it's one of the hardest things that I've ever been part of. That I've ever worked on, and I think Ross would agree, because he's not one at all to want to not talk. You know what I mean? Like he is an active and dynamic communicator, and has proven that since he's been here. The case and the way that the process works, you know, you have the confidentiality piece, which is a very, very important piece to the NCAA. Very important. In fact, so important that they addressed it on the conference call after the Committee on Infractions decision. I mean, and the way you could tell by the way they addressed it, they weren't happy with what had gotten out anyway. And it certainly wasn't from us, because we were quiet.
Oh yeah,
we were uncomfortably quiet. But you could sense right then that how they value and what maybe some of the repercussions are of not. Being confidential about the process. So you have these certain kind of milestones in the process, whether it's the, you know, receiving NOA or receiving a second NOA or you know, committee on infractions and then the final report when it's done. And so you have these milestones where you have these big public events or these big public, you know, statements or some sort of PR presence. But before that, and in the time leading up to that, you're bound by this confidentiality. And so it is, I cannot even tell you how frustrating it is coming from a communications person or marketing person like me. And again, like Ross, to have that process like that and not be able to talk and not be able to respond to every single thing. And so you did during that time, there were narratives that were going through. And look, we were, you know, as working as hard as we could within the confidentiality piece to make sure that stories were corrected when they were something inaccurate in it, to you know, continue to develop relationships with some of the media members out there. And again, it comes out, there's probably two or three, four writers, probably three that were really almost kind of hell bent on pushing the narrative that they had in a way that they just were not going to see the other way. Yet, you know, people don't look at ESPN or SC Network or even our local media, and we were treated fairly in a lot of those, and that wasn't by accident. I mean, we were, you know, again, actively trying to make sure that people, you know, were reporting on us accurately and fairly. And so it also is this really weird spot where, you know, you have an NOA, two NOAs, and there are things, you know, even when you read our response that we admitted to, there were allegations, they were true. Like, so we look, we admit it. We are going to take responsibility for that, and we are going to address those, and we're going to put things in place to prevent those from happening. And so it gets you in this weird spot of saying, you know, publicly coming out guns blazing, be like, no. We didn't do that. Now, we did this over here, and we're admitting to all this over here, but we didn't do that. And so when you get into this semantics game of trying to you know, spin or wiggle out of taking responsibility over on this side for this side, that's a dangerous spot to be. That's a really dangerous spot to be. And it's something that we had to bite our tongue. And then the other thing that was, you know, talked about, and the exemplary cooperation thing is something that I don't know where that narrative started, but it was never a strategy. It wasn't.
It's a mitigating factor.
It's a mitigating factor, but we didn't get it.
Yeah.
We weren't granted that. And so what they can only tell you one thing. I guess we didn't cooperate enough because we didn't get it. If we were sitting here and we were granted exemplary cooperation and still got the punishments that we got, or still got the penalties that we got, this would be a really different discussion. But behind the scenes, I think you can now see with the documents that we put out that there was a serious fight going on, a serious fight going on. But one thing that this is probably the most important thing. This is something that took a lot of discipline to do, because emotionally and just human nature wise, this was difficult. Is that throughout this process, when we would meet to talk about you know, communications and how we were going to discuss this and within the confidentiality clause and within these, you know, press events or PR kind of milestones. We had to say, and it was still probably the right thing, is that the Committee on Infractions was audience number one. There was a group of people that could decide how this case was going to end, and it was them. And they were audience number one. So we had to, all of our stuff, everything that we did, from a press conference to a statement, everything we put on the website, we looked at it. How is the Committee on Infractions going to read this? Because they were reading it all. They were watching it all. They were seeing how we reacted to everything. And so we had to be hyper focused on them as audience number one, our fans as audience number two in this scenario, and which is a you know, again, as a communications person, as a PR person, marketing person, that's not a fun place to be in. You always want your fans, your constituents, to be audience number one. But when there's another group of people that has the kind of influence and impact that this Committee on Infractions was going to have on our program, the only rational and logical thing to do to protect this program was to make sure that when we communicated thinking through the lens of how they would view it, and make sure that we did not, you know, jam our toe, shoot ourselves in the foot, whatever, you know, saying you want to use with that. Because at that time could have been catastrophic. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, I get that. So, I mean, in a lot of what people are talking about exemplary cooperation, it's really more the confidentiality agreement than that. I mean, those are really almost interchangeable, at least in their arguments, it comes off to me, on why certain things happen. So let me ask it this way, and I don't know the answer to this. What do you feel like you guys, I mean, you had lots of outside counsel, you had different things. Do you feel like you did anything different than other programs of similar stature that have been through these same instances where it didn't, and now look, I was kind of flying 10,000 feet over. I wasn't in their message boards every day and that type of thing, but it doesn't appear that they were characterized in the same breath as you guys of being extremely compliant, extremely helpful, turning in the amount of documentation that you turned in, all those different things. It just seems like you were kind of in a different PR spot than a lot of those programs.
I think it may, that may be perception.
Okay.
But I don't think that that's true at all.
Okay.
But I will say that there's a one massive difference, and I think contributed heavily to to the narrative and to the angst that our fans have been through. That's very different from any of the other cases. The length of time that the case took, and not, in some ways, just dumb luck. I mean, when you think about how the case unfolded, and the different events that occurred, whether it's you know, a few summers ago with Laramie and his stepdad, you know, that became a kind of a catalyst event for what happened after that, and then we were done, and we had received first NOA. We you know, we weren't self-imposing a postseason ban. I mean, that was a very, very manageable NOA, very, very manageable. And then draft night happens, which, again, there's no allegations that came from that, but it was a catalyst to reopen. And then in the meantime, while that's happening, you've got interviews happening that we didn't know were happening, and that's clearly documented in the case. And so, but you have this case that just gets drawn out, and as seems like we're kind of getting to the finish line, it's like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me! Like, and so there's these constant extensions, and so. That to me takes the PR piece and just raises it to an exponential power. You know what I mean? Because it's this length of time that happens, and you got longer periods of being quiet and staying inside of that confidentiality, and that just over time just continues to just eat and build momentum within the fan base of we're just rolling over and taking it, which is just not. Wasn't accurate when you read the documents, and certainly wasn't accurate because we didn't get exemplary cooperation as a mitigating factor.
So everybody talks about the tweet from Hugh in 2013, and that's become the big running joke. And I get how it probably wasn't the smartest thing in the world. I don't think that was as big of a deal from a detriment as far as his statement, June 29, 2015, right after the fight with Laramie and Lindsey Miller. And Freeze issued the following statement for those who don't remember. We can confirm Laramie Tunsil turned himself in and was arrested for a misdemeanor domestic violence simple assault. The incident occurred Thursday night and involves Laramie defending his mother against his stepfather. Laramie realizes he could have handled it differently, but I'm proud of him for standing up for his mother and protecting his family. Laramie and his mother have also pressed charges against the stepfather. As we gather more facts, we'll act and, accordingly, whatever. It absolutely ignited Lindsey Miller in a lot of his movements past that point. Or at least that's the way I infer things from here. What do you kind of remember about this all going on? Because that was also a spice point that, as you said a second ago, kind of kept this thing going on. And I think it ramped it up because past that point, Lindsey became much more aggressive with a lot of his allegations.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be speculating if I could say what motivated him to get ramped up.
Of course.
I don't remember a ton about that tweet. I mean, obviously remember having, but I do remember thinking that, you know, this is a football coach who has, you know, been told by his player what happened, or and he wants to defend his football player for, you know, with the information that he had at the time. And I think that that's exactly when Coach Freeze put that tweet out. I think that's exactly what he thought.
But that was not a PR statement put out by the university.
I don't think it was. I don't.
You were wrong.
No, I don't think it was. I think that was a head coach that was, you know, one of his players was in trouble, and he thought for an honorable reason, and he came to defend him. That's how I remember it. I'm not 100% sure on, but that's how I remember it.
Was there any thoughts? Because I can remember when you guys finally first released that first NOA, May, whatever it was, I guess 16 now, it's all running together. I thought, this isn't very bad. There's not much in here. It is what it is. And obviously, I know you wanted to get your voice out with response and wait the 3 months. But when all that stuff first starts coming out, 40's got the story. I think maybe David Brandt came with an AP story the same day or two. And you guys gave the much talked about semantics of Nutt and Tunsil and how much was Freeze. Was there ever any thought of just giving the NOA out at that point? Because to me, with considering what was in it, it kind of spoke for itself even without your response in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but, you know, hindsight is 2020. Our position on it was that it was – unfair to have the you know, let's say kind of the charges out there.
If the it's plaintiff, like, summary.
The prosecution's summary out there and the amount of time that it takes to write the defense. And so the fair thing to do is to have them both be public at the exact same time. I mean, that is no one can question that. That is the fair thing to do. Otherwise, for 90 days, the speculation of what these mean and what these, you know, how we're going to defend it. I mean, that's, again, now you're in this no man's land of you're certainly not going to respond to articles or stories or things like that in that time period that aren't necessarily counter, because you're working on your defense. You're literally writing the defense and how you're going to respond to that notice. And so, you know, put it this way, if the first NOA is where all of this stopped, that was the right thing to do. I mean, that would have been the right thing to do. We would have posted them both at that time and moved on. And you and I wouldn't be sitting here probably having this podcast. But that's – so you couldn't see into the future that NOA 2 was coming. That's what a lot of people forget about NOA 1, is that a lot of people have forgotten that in that moment, there's no way we could predict that a second NOA was coming. We thought that was not even possible at this point. And so we thought it was over. And at that point, you're dealing with the information that you have at that time, and you try to make the best possible decisions you can make with the information that you have. And so, we go back to, that was the fair thing to do for all involved, is to publish both documents when we had published the response to the NOA and the NOA. And again, that would make people understand, okay, this is what they've charged with and this is how they're responding. And it's a complete picture as opposed to half the picture.
What were to what extent was, I guess, Hugh and then the prospects and their family prepared for and given knowledge of things during that weekend that everybody talks about for the visit weekend?
They were, I mean, Coach Freeze asked for a summary, and of what the person who he had, some talking points, mm-hmm. and we produced that for him, and it was thorough and it was accurate to a T. And how he and Ross spoke to the recruits that weekend, and told them exactly what, basically. Well, I mean, he said what was in the talking points, but what you just said was that first NOA. I mean, it was very
standard.
I mean, standard and very,
as much as NOA.
And how I described it earlier, it was very, very manageable.
Yeah.
Very manageable. We were not in self-imposing a postseason ban. We didn't think that the allegations or the penalties warranted that in the penalty matrix. And so, I mean, we're just, you know, moving on, business as usual, being transparent about it and moving on. And so, again, it's information we had at the time before things that had happened in the future actually happened. And it's, again, you look back and it's like, well, golly, had we known that X, Y, and Z were going to happen later, then I think everything would change. But no one can see that in the future. It's not even possible. We're talking about something that's literally impossible to do.
Take a break in this interview to tell you the podcast brought to you in part by Community Mortgage, located in Oxford, Memphis, Soto County, and Chattanooga. All underwriting and processing is done in Memphis, so you're getting local underwriting that understands your market. Also a leader in condo financing in Oxford. So that's Jason about the float down option, which allows you to lock in the current rate, but if rates go down before you close, you get the lower rate. 662-234-2704. JLOWE at communitymtg.com. Podcast also brought to you by MasterCuts Lawn and Landscape. MasterCuts, a full-service lawn maintenance and landscape company serving Oxford, Tupelo, and the surrounding area. Whether it's building that outdoor kitchen, getting the outdoor living area, or just needing somebody to cut your grass as often as possible, MasterCuts can help you out. And you can get a free quote, 662-607-7773, or mastercutslawn.com. And last but not least, always, we tell you about Tyson Drugs in Holly Springs, tysondrugs.com, 662-252-2321. They can deliver the medicine to you wherever you are. They can help you out, and they have the sildenafil we tell you about all the time. Also, they have now bought and are beginning an Oxford pharmacy, so check them out there as well with G&M, and they will help you out if you're local to Oxford. So again, in Holly Springs, tysondrugs.com. Yeah, and I mean, there's been a lot of revisionist history with, I mean, I'm saying this, you don't have to, I mean, with, you know, players and signees and what happened and not to benefit their own interests down the road. But, no, that makes sense. I guess go here. Kind of last thing on this. I'm going to make it open-ended. What would you say to the fan? Because I get asked this all the time, and I think it's a fair question, because nuance and understanding the exact way that things happen, I'm not sure that's known. What do you say to the fan that questions, whether it be, you know, the university collecting coaches' material for the investigation, between it being, you know, the expansive amount of documentation that's required to give the NCAA during their investigation, but just that way that I guess the partnership or the the methods of the way compliance kind of interacts during this that is in a way that that is, I guess, standard would be the way to put it, that appears to have come off to a lot of fans in a more aggressive approach than maybe a lot of places.
Yeah, I think that's perception. I think that's I don't think that it's – I think it's very standard. And I'll answer it this way. If someone accuses you of something, you can respond to that accusation in one of two ways, maybe even one of three ways. Let's just say one of two. Okay. You can say, no, I didn't do that. Get out of my face. You know, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or you can say, no, I didn't do that. And here's the proof. Here's proof. I'm going to give you hard evidence of that says that I didn't do this. I mean, that's take any court of law. I mean, you know, you exonerate, you find evidence that clears. And so the way that any evidence would work, I don't care what it is, when you're charged with something, you're going to use everything you can to defend yourself. I mean, that's just the key. And so you gather information, you gather documents, you gather records, you gather anything you can that will exonerate you and prove to that other person that you didn't do what they're accusing you of doing. And that's how we live. You can't just look at somebody and be like, no, you're wrong. Go away. It just doesn't work that way.
And then some of it ended up just being incriminating as it got pulled together. You know, I mean.
you'd have to read the reports on that, yeah, and the full responses on that. And you can kind of see how, yeah, I mean, you just have to read the full
I think that's
on
the
that.
Frustrating part with fans, though, is it's just from a pure optic standpoint. I understand it is, well, okay, we did this, and I get it, but now we're turning ourselves in. We're the assault victim that's taking, or the assault, you know, perpetrator that's taking the hammer and handing it to the judge in a lot of ways.
I think that's probably a stretch.
Maybe hammer's not the way to
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a, I mean. I think that's a big stretch. I think that the other way to look at it is, we're going to do things the right way.
Yeah.
I mean, period. We are going to do things the right way. And so if you uncover something that's where there's an issue, mm-hmm, then you deal with it. I mean, you deal with it the right way. And that's the way that we're going to continue dealing with it. If you want to look at it in a totally different perspective, you say, name some sort of cover up that has actually worked out. Like you know, I guess we wouldn't know it because it wouldn't be public, but it worked out. Yeah. But you know, a cover up is probably the worst possible thing you can do. It proves to people that and questions everything that you do. As soon as you cover something up or try to cover something up, you're putting the integrity of this entire university on the line, and for a long, long, long time. There's one thing that I know that we can do. We can put our heads down at night, is know that we are going to continue to do the right thing. And the right thing, when you see something that's wrong, when there's a something that's happened that is against the rules, my gosh, you're going to have integrity and deal with it and deal with it head on. And so I know Ross doesn't have any qualms about that. I don't have any qualms about that because that's what we're here to do. We're here to do the right thing. That's what we're going to continue to do.
Did the appeals process, did that stop with unofficial restriction, or visitor restriction, bowl ban, and then LOIC? Was that the things being appealed, or is there more?
Well, it's more complicated than that. Okay. You fill out a form.
Okay.
And you're talking about which violations you're appealing. So it's
violation more than result.
Yeah, more than that. But you're also going to appeal some penalties, but sometimes you're going to appeal the penalties through the violations.
Okay. That makes sense.
But those are the things. I mean, when you look at what we self-imposed versus what was added,
you can figure it out.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, they accepted all of our self-imposed with the exception of pretty much two things.
Do you expect any, it's a PR, but public response from your office or Ole Miss in general regarding anything that you felt that the investigative staff or anything NCAA related did untoward, or do you think the documents were where y'all kind of leave things with that part moving forward?
I can't speculate on that because I think a lot of that would depend on
the
how
result.
The yeah I think a lot of that would depend on the result. I wish we were done today. I think that our conversation and a conversation that you would have with Ross would probably be more candid, just because we're still in this kind of not quite done yet with the appeals process. Yeah, and it's changed a good bit, but. Yeah, you just never know. I mean, after that, and we've talked about it. We've looked at a thousand different ways about how we you know move on after the appeals process. I mean, I will say this. I mean, obviously, the worst is over. I mean, yeah. There's
it
no
can't get worse. It, than
no,
over,
no. I mean, so. It's the and you know so much of the challenge of this whole thing, Not just from an employee standpoint like me, but you know, the fan's perspective is the unknown. I mean, the fear of the unknown is incredible. And so you have this kind of cloud, this thing that just kind of continues to, as soon as it looks like it's passing, it's over, you know, it's back in full force. And it's this, the what's tied to it is this, okay, what is going to happen? What is going to happen? This fear of the unknown, and that was palpable. I mean, for at least the last, you know, 2 years mm-hmm. of this, but we're past that. I mean, there's an unanswered question or two and some the penalty things, but it certainly cannot get worse. And so that's I think that's been the hardest part of it, the angst and the fear of the unknown, but it cannot get worse. And so we're going to press on, and how we press on after the appeals process, we haven't decided yet because that process is still going.
The type of question that's probably there were is hopefully the thing we talk about in the future when we do these shows and different things. And something I forgot earlier, people seem to like it, the little script M thing, just the one letter, not the full Ole Miss script. What's the future of how it's going to be implemented in the brand?
You know, this kind of it somewhat goes back to the mascot question about going full bore. I mean, you look at with a bear, when you look at other schools, so many other schools have these other marks that are part of their licensing portfolio, and most of the time they're mascot related. And we started working on that signature M before. I mean, we started working on that signature M 2 years ago. So, I mean, the talk of Landshark hadn't even entered the discussion. I mean, none of that had happened. So we were actually working on the signature M to just, again, kind of bolster our licensing portfolio and give licensees and manufacturers something new that they could work with, because they've been working with the script Ole Miss. They've been working with sometimes the Block M, but we've never really, the Block M is just not, it's just not all the way us, you know. It just looks. I mean, you can interchange it with lots of other schools.
So put the script M on the baseball hat.
So, well, you know, there's a baseball hat in my office that's got a script M on it. But it's something that is a really unique mark that only we have, and which is awesome. So it's ownable.
It's still
very
relatable.
It's the M from Ole Miss, and it has this. It just has a different look to it. It has a different feel to it, and so. It's one of those things that we're going to kind of, you know, we're going to gradually, but we're methodically and strategically inserting it into places. You don't want to, we're not going away from Ole Miss. That's the whole point. I mean, it's the M from Ole Miss. But you want to make sure that you don't just flood it all of a sudden, and then it's not nearly as cool or new.
I get the Block M's just baseball related for the most part, but yeah. is it a little weird though as a brand person to have two different M's in different styles?
No, really not at all. Okay. I mean, if you look at Ole Miss, there's this Ole Miss script, and then there's the Ole Miss and collegiate, the Block. Which the Block is a.
So
is
you're
a,
just taking them from both.
And, yeah, yeah. Really, it's what you've done, and that's very, very common.
Okay.
I mean, most logo sheets, approved logo sheets are going to have many logos on them for different uses. You know, the M is the way that it's the shape and size of it. It works great on caps. It works great in certain spots, you know, like on the, if you're wearing shorts, kind of like basketball shorts on the right above the thigh, mm-hmm. you know, there's great, you know, applications for that mark. And it's also different. It's fresh. And so licensees, we see that because we don't have we will have Landshark marks eventually, but we haven't had the mascot marks as part of that portfolio. So we were trying to kind of diversify the portfolio in a different way. And now we're kind of get lucky and be able to add several marks to that to that portfolio.
Is there any thought, even in the intermediate to moderate future, of using even a secondary land chart mark on a uniform at all, or is it simply a secondary deal?
Well, we haven't. We're almost done with the design of the costume.
Okay.
And so the mark, the eventual mark will kind of be born out of that. You want them to be related, so you got to start with one and then go from the other. We started with the costume, and then we'll there'll be a mark or marks that kind of come out of that. It's also got a lot of legs. And when you think about it, I mean, that's kind of a weird expression to use on a fish or walking fish for that matter. I'm like having an inception moment here. Cause yeah, our land shark does have legs. There'll be other marks there, and it's going to open up really a lot more possibilities that are going to be a lot of fun, and people are going to love. I mean, you already see some of the stuff out there. And so, people have already embraced it. I mean, we would have never, I mean, I'm telling you, in the years of Bear, I literally cannot think of a single time people walked in our stadium wearing like a Bear hat. I mean, like literally just.
Oh, you meant like just a stuffed
Bear. Just a stuffed Bear. There's stuffed Shark hats coming into the stadium all the time now.
And we didn't create those. That I saw them the most is on drivers.
Head covers.
That's the one place
that's
where
exactly
I
right.
see Bears.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They have other Ole Miss things, but they got rid of the Colonel Reb head cover and bought Bears.
Yeah.
I saw Bears.
That was probably the one item that moved, you know, and in a very niche market, as you can imagine.
Well, yeah, of course.
I mean, people are putting custom head covers on
there. I still think stuffed teddy bears with Ole Miss clothing on would have sold.
They did.
And still marketed to kids.
Yeah, we had that. Yeah. We had that. That was one of the few things. Again, everything we did was marketed to kids. We had merchandise out there, but it was all kids items.
If it's plush and soft, you had your daughter, she's going to sleep with it, whatever.
Oh, yeah. They were having a clearance sale on Bears at the Rebel shop like a month ago.
So your next question is going to be from everybody, because you're obviously getting rid of Rebels now because you have the land shark.
Oh,
so,
gosh. No, we're the Ole Miss Rebels. We'll always be the Ole Miss Rebels.
There's still a lot Rebels. Of money on that. So, I mean, from an economic standpoint, the amount of money you guys have spent on branding
It's so valuable. The Ole Miss name is so valuable, and it's so positive nationally. The brand studies that have been conducted about the Ole Miss brand, it's incredible. And look, we're in it. We live it. I mean, it's you know, like family to us. We take for granted a lot the amount of power that the Ole Miss brand has. I mean, when you travel all over the country, this is a very, very powerful brand, and one that has an extremely positive connotation.
Do you think it adds to some of the confusion because you're one of the few flagship institutions not known as the state name, and some of just the Mississippi versus Ole Miss? I mean, do you think that is something you guys have to, from a national level, fight at times on misunderstandings?
I don't think so, because you default to what's the more recognizable name. Does it matter if they know that you're the flagship? I think that
not necessarily that, but just in general. I mean, do you think 95% of sport fans, and they say, hey, University of Mississippi, in their heads automatically Ole Miss?
I don't know if it'd be that high, but I think it's high.
Okay.
It's high. It's if anything, it's the reverse. People know us as Ole Miss, but may not know that we're the University of Mississippi. I think that's probably the trigger one. But at that point, it doesn't
You're an
matter.
SEC school named Ole Miss,
right?
And whatever.
At that point, it doesn't matter. You know, as long as they know us as Ole Miss, and you know, and they have a positive view of our brand and a positive feeling about us, then that's what's important. Okay. And I think they do. I really do. I think our brand is. We have an extremely healthy brand, an extremely positive brand when it comes to, you know, coast to coast. And it's something that we're going to continue to build. There's no doubt.
Appreciate the time. How should people contact you with questions? You're around on the message board some, and you have an email address.
I have an email address, mtjr@oleMiss.edu. I try to respond as quickly as I can. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer than I can. And one thing you didn't ask me about that I have gotten emails about, and I've responded, it was about the pavilion and the cameras.
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah. Go ahead.
Let me address that real fast. So the networks, ESPN and SC Network, I mean, we have to have shots at the benches. I mean, the two high cameras, they require you to have camera positions that face the coaches and the bench, because when something happens, one of the first things they want to do is go to a react of, you know, Andy Kennedy or Davis or whoever on the bench and show the reaction. So when you look at it, when you watch a televised basketball game, that's one of the most bread and butter shots that a network requires. And so you have to fit that in with the other unique aspect of the pavilion, where we put students on around three quarters of the court. And so you can't have the students, the SC rule is you can't have the students behind the visiting bench.
Right.
And so they're either going to get shot over from those high cameras that are shooting towards the bench. Or you use the handhelds that are roving the baseline to show some of the students. And, you know, it's one of those things you kind of have to decide what you do. What we wanted to do was we wanted to put first and foremost, you know, the experience inside the pavilion, number one, which is why we wanted the students low and we wanted them wrapped, you know, around the three quarters. And that makes for an awesome, you know, in arena home court advantage. But again, it's one of the cons of that is that you're not going to get them on camera as much, but you still get them on camera plenty. But there's no, you can't have it both ways. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to build a new building, you're going to build it to try to future proof it as much as possible. And that's what we did. And so
you did lower the cameras now.
Yeah. They're lower. And you know,
it was kind of space at first. It was way up.
It was zoomed out.
Yeah.
And you know, what was interesting was that the zooming out, the camera angle was a directive from the network. And so they're saying, Oh yeah. And then they changed it. They changed it probably three games in or four games in and said, no, you know what? I think there was a change. I think that the production guy was no longer there. And so whoever came in was like, no, we want to be tighter in on the court. And so it was one of those things we were following instruction from the SC network, who we were, you know, broadcasting the game for in that scenario, or ESPN or ESPN2, whoever it was. They all have the same standards and specs. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that we have to do. I mean, there's no other way around it. But, you know, I think it's important to know that, you know, we want that place rocking inside the building. And it's weird to say, but, you know, for the people that are watching at home, they're going to be second to what we can do inside that building, because the people who are watching at home can't necessarily give us the home court advantage that we want. And so we've designed the building in a way that gives our team the best chance to win. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if you lose a little bit on TV, then you do. And it's just the way that it is.
Hope a lot of the things were covered for you today. We'll obviously follow up if we missed anything. So, again, appreciate the interaction there from the subscribers. You can email Michael if you have further questions. And we'll talk to you again on Wednesday.
Thanks.